Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 414th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron Bill Mann, good buddy of ours. You can check out some of his work at theppsgroup.co. He's actually someone we've spoken about on the podcast before, so thanks, Bill, for joining the Patreon. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we've got Avril Speaks on the show. She's got a new podcast called Distribution Advocates Presents. Avril is part of a squad of like-minded filmmakers who banded together to advocate on behalf of filmmakers and educate on the nature of distributing your film and also rethinking or thinking through alternative ways of distributing your films in the doc space, but feature space as well, all over the place. It's a really great conversation, and we kind of dive into the top line nuggets of the episodes that they cover. So all of the different topics that they hit upon, like they talk about sales agents, they talk about awards, film festivals, film school, exhibition, and of course, distribution. So we kind of touch upon each of those topics. If you're curious, if you want to check out more about what they have to say, you can go to distributionadvocates.substack.com and dig into all of the resources that they've created for filmmakers. It's a pretty cool conversation.
Yeah. Did you know that Avril is a recipient of the inaugural Dear Producer Award?
No, that's great.
Yeah. Dear Producer is the site and kind of movement. I don't know. Rebecca Green, a former guest, also producer. She produced It Follows and a bunch of other cool things. And Avril is also, aside from being an expert and kind of educator on distribution, she's also a producer and a director and a showrunner. She has a show with Netflix. She's, you know, had films at South By and worked with Sundance and done all sorts of cool things. But, you know, in our conversation, she tells us that Sundance isn't the be-all, end-all of filmmaking. So hopefully that is either good news or bad news.
Yeah, I think like it's really a conversation about reframing what is right for your film and that it's not a one-size-fits-all solution. And I think for a long time, we, for better or worse, hoped that it was, right? And like we, countless filmmakers, practically every person we know, has had this mentality of like, well, I should at least apply, you know. I think that there's an undercurrent of like, because that is the best thing for any film, which is not necessarily true. And this isn't an anti-Sundance or anti-film festival conversation by any means, but like, it's more about opening up your eyes to alternatives and also really trying to drill down and question, like, what is the right path for your film and how can you build a strategy around it?
Totally. Yeah, it's a fun convo and I'm excited for y'all to listen to it.
You and I went to the Kodak.
I forgot about that.
The Kodak Awards about a week ago now.
Yeah, I don't think I talked to you since then.
The funny thing about hosting a podcast is you end up on press lists. And so we ran into a handful of previous guests. It was at the ASC Clubhouse, which is like pretty cool. It's across the street from the Magic Castle. I bring it up because it's award season, mentioned later in this conversation. My wife was at the PGA event.
I went to the commercial nominees awards or meet the nominees.
What's cool about it, this is not just bragging about some fun parties people get to go to, but does it reinvigorate you? Does it kind of like inspire you in any way?
Yeah. I mean, I'm like into the bragging about the fun parties, especially for us, since you know we don't go to a lot of fun parties.
Sure.
And I think to me, like the funniest part of the night is that both of us had the same reaction. Like we showed up and they have like a check-in for guests and a check-in for press. And you got there earlier than me, classic. And low, and you're like, oh, we check in at the press, you know, area.
Well, only in relation to you, Oren, am I the early one.
Yeah, no, that's, I meant classic in terms of our relationship.
Sure,
not in terms
sure.
of who you are as a
yeah, though human. I did get there early and was kicking myself because,
yeah,
you know.
No, it's, your reaction from getting there early made it clear to me that you're not used to getting places early.
Yeah.
Because you were like, there's only 35 people here. Yeah, what am I going to do?
Just like, oh, gosh. Well, and it's also, it's been a minute since I was at one of those events. And I used to go to stuff like that all the time. And as a result, you know you're going to run into people that you know what I mean? But like I said, it's been a minute since I've gone out and all of that. And of course we ended up running into a handful of people, but like that thing of like, oh dang, am I going to just be standing in the corner, like making eye contact with each waiter who knows that I'm just going to like silently eat something every single time they swing by. And is that going to be my whole night until Oren gets here? Oh dang. He's not going to be here for 2 hours.
Think about it from their point of view. If you're catering at an event, like an award event at the ASC Clubhouse, it's not like a huge event. There's probably like 100 people there, you know? So
yeah,
most people there,
for sure, but yeah,
had some, you know, influence. You're really good at, like, I would never know what Christine Vachon looks like in a million years. You're pretty good at pointing out some people, but we saw, you know, Matthew J. Lloyd, who was on the podcast, and
Louisa Vick was also on the podcast.
Yeah, his agent, and Ava DuVernay, who he worked with, was there. Mm-hmm. And so
she was so fun, man.
I think if you're as a server, yeah, so we did not talk to Ava, but we should have.
I will say, you know how every once in a while you see a filmmaker, you're like, oh, they've got it. No wonder. A genius across the board. Like, just like so good at working the room. I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, she is kind of like course. Radiates yeah. like charisma and yeah. confidence. But even yeah. Celine Song, who kind of like underplays it, I thought like when she went up to speak, is like such a good speaker, you know? Mm-hmm. Like she knows interesting things to say.
Well, also, you know, it reminds me of film festivals. When you, if you're playing a handful of festivals and, you know, you're doing a bunch of panels, you can tell like, the early panel versus the late panel anecdotes. Do you know what I mean? Like people get their shtick kind of dialed in a couple panels in. And so at a certain point, you know, you try to be interviewer proof for like if you know, you just kind of have a couple good jokes or a couple ways into different stories that you know are going to land. I imagine that there's a version of that, on these people who were doing pretty heavy duty PR tours. You know what I mean?
But what was so kind of weird about this event, it was the Kodak Film Awards. Mm-hmm. So the only eligible people to win these awards are people who made their movies on literal film, like celluloid. So every speech was like, you know, we decided to shoot on film and it made all the difference. So they haven't given that speech a lot, you know?
What's funny is that I didn't even put it together until a couple awards in. I was like, oh, we're only going to talk about celluloid tonight.
Yeah. No, it is weird. But but back to like when we got there and we got in, you know, we had to check in as press and they gave us these lanyards. Both you and I are like, what the hell? We are not putting these lanyards on. We are filmmakers. We're here as filmmakers. And yeah, we happen to have a podcast and we happen to know some of these people, but like, you know, the people that we ran into, like some of them, you know, we know from outside of the podcast also. And I don't know, there's just this weird, like, I've never thought of like press at an event as like second class until I was press.
Well, it kind of depends also, though, on that's, I think that says a lot more about us than it does about press, because I think there are plenty of people who grew up dreaming of being great reporters.
Like a reporter, yeah.
Like lots of status.
Right. If you're like Roger Ebert and you walk in there and everyone's like, ooh, sure. It's Roger. Who's he gonna
talk to? You know, Matt Bellamy from The Town or whatever. Hey, I'd be very excited to meet him. And also, like, he doesn't have a chip over on his shoulder. He's like, hey, you know, I'm going to report on this tomorrow. And, you know.
But to us, I guess instantly when they're like, you're press, it made me feel like, oh, I'm here for work and everyone else here is for the party, you know?
Everyone was there for work, Oren.
Yeah, but you know what it is. Like, I'd rather be there to schmooze than to, like, report. But then, of course, while we were doing the awards, we were standing in the back of the room, so we had a pretty bad view. And I'm like, hey, we are here for press. And I, like, walked right to the front. I started, like, photographing everyone and putting it on our Instagram because I was like, I mean, this is why they invited us. I guess we might as well walk to the front and, like,
I think take honestly,
a picture of Hoyte van Hoyte,
cool dude. I wish we'd talked to him. That would have been nice. He was around.
He seemed very easy to talk to.
Yeah. And like you're just surrounded by world class DPs for sure.
Yeah. Fun. Everyone there is someone something.
Really, yeah.
Yeah. And at the end of the night, we ran into some actors that were like, come drink with us at the Roosevelt. And I was like, yeah, party time. Mm-hmm. And you went home and I went and partied for at least another hour.
I think that both of us are pretty happy with our decisions. To be fair, you also had history and you were old friends.
Yeah, I knew one. The person that, that invited us.
I had just met everyone. They were all very nice, but I was like, I'm going to go see my wife.
I guess I'm in this. You know, I have two kids and a wife, and I have just this social life that does not revolve around like going to parties and like randomly going to bars afterwards. And it just seemed like, ooh, this is something that has not happened every night for me. Sorry, I bet most of our listeners are like, Oren, you just literally, that's like what going out is. It's like you go and you meet people and you go somewhere else. But to me, that was quite rare. So it was exciting to go meet a bunch of new actors and, you know, head honchos and producers and people and drink. And, you know, I'm sure you'll be very disappointed to hear that at the end of my drinking and snacking at the Roosevelt, I asked who I could pay. And they're like, it's taken care of. Don't worry. So
That's nice.
It's extra nice when someone has paid for all of your entertainment.
It is funny. There is a vibe to a certain type of actor, and this was like a whole squad of people where you're like, yes, I can tell that you're all like kind of famous, but I can't put my finger on how I know you, and that's going to just be hanging in the air until we figure it out eventually.
Until
you know what I mean?
I go home and
you
every
IMDb
single
somebody.
One of you on IMDb.
Yeah.
There was this one actress there named Tiffany, and I was like, I've seen you in so many things, but I don't know her last name, so I just typed in Tiffany into IMDb, and inconclusive result. So I'll never know. I might have been hanging out with, you know.
Amber Thiessen.
Yes. Was it her? No, it wasn't her.
No,
I would know Tiffany.
Yeah, you would know.
Anyhow, clearly one of us cares more about this than the other.
Well, let me ask you, were you like, should I shoot on film?
Oh, well, I was going to say absolutely not, but to me, I would shoot on film.
I drank a little of the Kool-Aid. I was like, maybe. Yeah.
If I had a lot of money. Like, I like to do a lot of takes and keep the camera running, because every time you say cut, it just stops you. So if I had a shoot where it was like I was the final say on like whether a take was good or not, then yeah, I would mess with film.
I think there's that. It would certainly change our habits, right? Like I instinctually will say still rolling, because I don't want people to jump in and, you know, adjust a lav mic or fix somebody's hair or like flip a collar down or whatever. I want, like, we're in the scene, nobody do nothing, we're still rolling. And we'll talk for 5 minutes, you know, and like that's annoying to an editor and, you know, I guess we spend money in hard drives or whatever, but you'd have to cut when you're rolling film.
Yeah.
But I think there is that thing of like,
I mean, it looks really good.
It looks really, it looks really
good. And it is like a precious, yeah, like everyone was like, the actors see the film camera and they're, ooh, this is a serious movie instantly.
Yeah, but, and take takes seriously, right? Like,
yeah,
I don't know that I have a rolling rehearsal.
Right. No, for sure.
Film, you know.
But, you know, Celine Song, who did Past Lives, was talking about shooting in South Korea. And she said that they just literally, there is no film shooting there. So they can't even process the film. They had to mail the film back to New York. And you can't see the footage you shot for like 3 or 4 days.
Ava DuVernay and Matthew Lloyd told an anecdote about how when they were shooting in India, they would send somebody on a train to Mumbai to develop the film because they had to send them by train to avoid X-rays from airplanes. You know, like airplane security would ruin your negatives.
Yeah, it's nerve-wracking.
That is. I'm nervous, and everything worked out okay for them.
Yeah.
I'm nervous on their behalf.
Who knows? I mean, when you shoot that much film, maybe you lose a role and it's okay.
Yeah, maybe.
Anyhow, if you want to support our budding journalism career, you should check out our Patreon. It's patreon.com/justshootapod. It's where you can go to give us $1, $2, $4. If you do join our Patreon at any number, we will mention you, and I will quickly try to assess what your website is or how to promote you right before we record an episode. So if you already are a patron and you want us to mention your website, your Instagram, your whatever, show your portfolio or Vimeo, email us justshootapod@gmail.com. If you're not, sign up for our Patreon, patreon.com/justshootapod. Super helpful. It's what helps this podcast keep going. It's what gets us into press events.
Also, we've got a live show coming up March 20th, the Lee Strasberg Theater. But if you go to patreon.com/justshootapod, you'll be in the know.
Okay. Anyhow, speaking of speaking, here's our spoken chat with Avril Speaks.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Avril Speaks. How's it going?
Good. It's going great.
Awesome. Thanks for coming to our podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You have your own podcast, Distribution Advocates Presents. So Presents is part of the name though, right?
It's part of the names. So it's actually a group of us. We're a collective called Distribution Advocates. Mm-hmm. And so the podcast is called Distribution Advocates Presents. We're so creative.
And so tell us about the group. Who are you? What's your mission? What's the Who are you? I mean,
yes. So Distribution Advocates is essentially a collective of producers who got together during the pandemic while, you know, when everything shut down and no films were being shot and everybody was kind of sitting around going, what's going to happen to the industry? Are we going to be able to make movies again? I don't know. You know, and there were just a lot of questions about what's happening and how do we still do this thing? And a bunch of us got on a call and somehow the conversation turned to distribution. And every single one of us had some kind of gripe or horror story or, you know, complaint about the state of distribution. And, you know, if you remember during that time, there were people, you know, some people were having conversations about like, you know, maybe this is our opportunity to like do things differently and make change in the industry. And so we started having conversations like that about distribution. Like, are there different ways that we can think about it? And also, you know, how is it that, you know, a lot of people don't really know the like what happens when you distribute a film and kind of what that process is about. And so we started having conversations about the distribution process, what it could look like to change.
And just to butt in for a second, when you say distribution, are you talking about feature films or
what? Say primarily feature films is kind of, I think that the majority of us are feature film producers, but you know, a lot of the issues that we were finding kind of just go across the board. It's shorts, it's features, it's, it's docs. It, you know, our work tends to focus more so on documentary films, but a lot of the stuff that we talk about and a lot of the things that we discovered during the process, apply to all different types of films. You know, the first thing that we tried to do was, you know, we figured we'd start with education. And so we just started going around to different organizations and kind of doing what we call teach-ins. So we would, you know, we created a cheat sheet, which if you go to our Substack, you can see our cheat sheet is on there. And it's just kind of like points. I think there's maybe like 13 points on there on what filmmakers should consider when they're putting a film into distribution.
And that's distributionadvocates.substack.com in case you're not driving right now.
Right. Exactly. And so we started doing those teach-ins and it just became really clear to us just how little people knew, you know, and people were contacting us and they were just saying like, this information is so, you know, needed. And thank you for publishing this information. And we started getting more requests to keep doing these teach-ins. And it got to be like, okay, this is a lot. Like we're having to keep, you know, repeat this information over and over again. So we figured let's do a podcast so that we can put the information on there. But then also the hope being that we can continue to have these conversations and hopefully, you know, further that conversation, the dialogue about how we might be able to envision different systems for how we distribute our movies and get them out into the world and into to audiences.
So that's so funny because I feel like Orin and I started this podcast in a similar sort of vein of just like, oh, when you're a young filmmaker, like people are just like, hey, can I pick your brain? Can we go to coffee? And you kind of feel like you would say the same things over and over again. And we were like, what if we said the same things over and over again on a podcast instead?
Right.
And every time someone asks us for some advice, we're like, just listen to this episode or this episode.
Exactly. Exactly. Well,
so you have kind of some awesome categories of things that you cover on the show. You talk about sales agents, awards, film festivals, film school, exhibition, and of course, distribution and presenting, I assume, and advocating. So if you don't mind, we're going to ask you just a little bit about each thing, like sales agents. What is that a thing? Like, I feel like sales agents are one of the kind of old school, at least when I first moved to LA and got into like Hollywood filmmaking in 2005, like almost 20 years ago, the sales agents were a thing. I haven't really been in the feature space for quite a few years, so I don't know if they're still a thing But what's the current status, you know, post COVID sales status on sales agents?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I will say one of the things about the podcast that we tried to do in terms of our format is we tried to root everything in storytelling. So we wanted to find filmmakers who had been through, you know, that topic and who had an interesting story to share. And the sales agent episode, we featured a filmmaker named Seth Hernandez, who did a film called Unseen. It's a documentary film. Did I say seen or unseen? It's called Unseen. You know, it was really interesting hearing that filmmaker's story because, you know, you ask kind of what is the current state of sales agents. It's like, you know, if you listen to Seth's story, I think, you know, you talk about, you know, young filmmakers who are getting into it for the first time and have these expectations. And I think in the case of Seth, you know, he came into this situation just saying like, I've made this film and, you know, people are out there that are going to help me move this film forward. They're going to help me find distribution. And, you know, for a film called Unseen, ended up feeling very unseen by sales agents. And, you know, that was sort of, you know, one of the big takeaways from that episode is just kind of that relationship of sales agents. And then also just kind of ending with that question of, you know, what would happen if we didn't need sales agents? Do we really need sales agents?
Right.
You know, and I think kind of just breaking down that perception that, you know, they're the roadblock to getting distribution, because the reality is like, you really can reach out to distributors on your own, or you can set up your own, you know, systems of distribution. The value of sales agents is that, you know, they, you know, have those kind of direct relationships with distributors. But it's all a matter of really taking into account, like, you know, where are you trying to put your film in the first place? And then does that make sense? Does that make the most sense to have that type of partnership? And like I said, you know, in the case of Seth, you know, their experience was just one where it wasn't one that felt very fruitful, or it didn't feel, you know, like their film was being cared for, if you will. And, you know, as filmmakers, we spend a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of resources in making the content that we do. And when you get to that point where you have a finished product, you know, you know,
Hope that someone's there to take the baton, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I am curious that about, it's funny because we've talked about sales. We've had sales agents on the show and they've, you know, been generally pretty great and informative, and they seem like decent people, which was not really my experience with my sales agent on my feature back in the day. But now that I think about it, if you do have a producer, you know, that's produced multiple indie films and sold multiple indie films, do you need, like, what is a sales agent? Do you even need a sales agent? Because, like, we had a sales agent because we had never sold a movie before. And Matt, you had a sales agent on See Your Next Christmas. But if you had a producer, you know, like,
who knew?
Like an Avril or like a Rebecca Green or like someone who's like sold indie films in the past, like, they just call, right? Like, you have a show with Netflix, right? Can you just call them and say, hey, I got this movie. Do you want to check it out? What's the sales agent for?
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's yes. You know, Netflix in and of itself has like, you know, 1,000 different divisions. So it's like, you know, doing a show with Netflix, you know, doesn't always translate to, you know, that right department, you know, that department of like, an indie film and who's doing acquisitions for those indie films. On the same token, yes, like if a producer, you know, or even directors in some regards, if they, you know, if you have that relationship and you know the acquisitions person, like you know, there's nothing stopping you from making that connection on your own.
Sure.
Like I said, you know, the value of sales agents is, you know, they're the people that have that direct access. But if you have that direct access and you, or someone on your team has that direct access on their own, then it's a question like, you know, Is it imperative? And also, is it something that, you know, does that give you a better chance mm-hmm. of your film getting distribution or not? Like it, you know, it might, sure. and it also might not, you know? Yeah.
You know, it brings to mind a really, really complicated aspect of the relationship between independent filmmaker and sales agent. I love your thoughts on, because there's two versions of the relationship that I feel like we've seen over the years. One where that sales agent is careless and gatekeeps, right? Like that isn't really delivering on the promises that they make. But then the flip side is sometimes those sales agents just have a more objective perspective on where your film fits in the marketplace, right? And as filmmakers and as dreamers and as artists, we're always like,
theatrical release.
Yeah. Or just like, you know, that like this is a diamond in the rough. I know exactly why this movie is special. And I know that there's an audience out there. And maybe people believe that it's a broader audience than it is in actuality or whatever, you know, but like that's always the case with a feature film. Like studios think that their movies have, you know, big broad appeal and there's flops all the time, right? So there's that balance, right, between like, oh no, this is the company that's right for you, even though it's smaller than what you were hoping for, and therefore the money is going to be much smaller than what you were hoping for, versus, like I said, gatekeeping, like just underestimating or just kind of trying to oversell on a library of movies where they're just kind of callously hoovering them up to maybe sell to a streamer at a, you know, a big old deal, a big old sale. How does that strike you?
I mean, you know, I always tell filmmakers, you know, only you know what your film, you know, in terms of what your goals are for the mm-hmm. film. And I always tell filmmakers, especially if they are going to go that direction of a sales agent, to really take in mind, it's exactly what you're saying. It's, does that sales agent and what their goals are, do those align mm-hmm. with your goals? Because I've been in scenarios where I've had films and, you know, we try to get a sales agent and then we've had two choices where we had like a big agency and then we had a tiny agency that was very honest about, look, this is what your film is, but here's how we can, you know, strategize to create the best type of, you know, kind of rollout plan or the best distribution mm-hmm. plan for the type of film that you have versus, you know, a larger film where you're, you know, your film is another number. They're, you know, and it's like you're saying, like they're gatekeepers and they're kind of like, okay, you belong in this library over here mm-hmm. and your film goes on a shelf and, you know, you get paid your money, if anything, and your film goes on a shelf. Most filmmakers want your film to have some, especially with indie filmmakers, we want your film to have some type of life. You want to have dialogue and you want to have impact and you want to have these types of things. Like I said, I've been in situations where we wanted those, you know, we wanted to have the dialogue, we wanted to have impact in the community, and that smaller sales agent was more on that wavelength mm-hmm. of being a little bit more tailored and to say, you know, maybe it's, you know, maybe we play non-theatrical in this market and maybe we sell to, you know, we sell educational and maybe we sell to this, you know, so it's kind of like piecemealing it so that you have a more tailored plan and a more tailored approach. So I was just, you know, one of the things when we started doing the teach-ins at Distribution Advocates, I think the first thing on that cheat sheet actually is, you know, figuring out what are your goals as a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I say this all the time. It's probably like a broke anybody who's ever heard me speak or, you know, on a panel or in a workshop or anything. I always tell this story about when I, you know, produced my first film, someone said to me, you can have money. She said, money, eyeballs, or impact. Pick one. And of course, as filmmakers, I'm like, I want all the things. Like, no, I don't want to pick just one. But
like Oppenheimer did it all.
Right, right. Exactly. But like, it does, you know, when you pick one, it does start to kind of make you sort of think, okay, what's the strategy for that? Like if it's money, then like, what's the strategy? If I need to make my investors money back, you know, and that's fine. That's fine as a goal. But what is the strategy for that? What's the strategy for impact? What's the strategy for eyeballs? And hopefully in a great scenario, you pick one and you get all of them, but that's because you have a tailored approach and you have, you know, so I think sales agents kind of falls into that as well. It's like, you know, choosing the ones that are going to align with whatever it is that you decide in terms of goals.
Right. My last question about sales agents before we move on is just the money. Like, you know, we've talked to distributors and sales agents and stuff on the podcast before. What's from your experience of like working with big agencies and also small, you know, like single person sales agents? Are you supposed to pay them money up front, or do they work on a commission? Or is it like, what if you have a tiny $150,000 film that might or might not be sellable? Like, why would the sales agent even take it on if there isn't any sort of guarantee for them?
Yeah.
How does the money work in that?
Well, first of all, you shouldn't have to pay a sales agent up front. If somebody's asking for money up front, you be wary of sales agents that are asking for that. Typically, a sales agent will take a percentage of your sale. So when your film sells, then they'll take a percentage of that minimum guarantee, which is kind of that, it's kind of like a loan against what your film is going to make in the long run. So, you know, when Sundance comes around, you always hear these stories about like, this film, you know, sold for, you know, such and such millions of dollars, or, you know, six figures or whatever. You know, that's your minimum guarantee that comes to the filmmaker, and your sales agent will take a percentage of that. And so that percentage can be anywhere. For a domestic sales agent, it can be anywhere. It could be, you know, 10, 15%, 20%. It's a bit higher for international sales agents, just because they have to sell to every territory, and it takes a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, you know, international sales agents, it can be up to 35%, you know, of that minimum guarantee or of those fees that they get. So it is something to keep in mind. It's like, that's another one of those things of, you know, working with a sales agent, they're also taking fees out of whatever, you know, out of your minimum guarantee or whatever monies you make. In addition to the distributor, they're also taking out their percent. They're also, you know, they're also going against that minimum guarantee, which, you know, I don't want to go into that whole thing, but, you know, it's like they're taking out their cut as well. Mm-hmm. So a lot of money is being kind of taken out, which is, you know, another thing to take into consideration in terms of what's right for you and how much you're looking to keep and how much of your rights you're interested in keeping on your film.
And I imagine that, like, that's really what we're talking about in terms of trade-offs, right? Like, okay, an international sales agent, if they're taking 35% of your MG, of your gross profits, right? Like, that's before, you know, net. And if you, boy, heaven forbid, like, you don't have like all of your music rights or all festival rights or something, things like that. There, movies always have other expenditures after they've sold. So if you get a certain MG, someone's taking 35% off the top, and then you've got to pay X number of dollars for a song that you need to license or whatever, and then a DCP and the, you know, encoding fees and blah, 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 you could end up with like very little that's a small pie to slice up, right?
Exactly.
Compared to keeping that 35%, basically, and, you know, calling up all of the different territories yourself, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's it. That seems like untenable unless you've,
sure,
you're going to, like, you know, the film markets on your own. I mean, it just seems like,
yeah,
impossible.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's, like you said, that's the trade-off. It's that's a lot of work. Like, when you think about all the territories that exist in the international space, you know, it's like, you know, Yeah. That's a lot.
Even just selling like airplane airlines and hotels and all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
A whole company's worth of people's jobs. Yeah.
Well, right. So, yeah. Yeah. So obviously that's kind of the business side of like getting your movie sold. But there is also the like accolade side. So, you know, I think that the other two things that you cover on your podcast are awards and film festivals. Can you tell us a little bit about, like how much that matters and how much that affects, you know, whether your movie is even sellable? I think kind of the common knowledge that we have on this podcast is, you know, if you get into like one of these top 5 to 10 film festivals, it makes all the difference. And then if you don't, you know, then it's a whole different ball game.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the things we try to do at Distribution Advocates is kind of dispel some of the myths that we have in filmmaking. I think, you know, when we had our initial, you know, meetup, you know, we all had stories about filmmakers who would come and we'd say, you know, come to us as producers and we'd say, okay, what's your plan? And they say, you know, we can make the film and then we'll get into Sundance and then it'll get bought by A24. And that's the plan. And
it's a pretty good plan. I mean,
it's a pretty good plan. What's wrong with it is that most films that, you know, we did a study in 2022 of the films that
I don't know if I want to hear this part.
One out of 7 Sorry. Million films get into Sundance.
My
One
soul's about to leave my 20, body.
Sundance films. Makes money. Yeah.
I mean, in all fairness, you know, like I said, a lot of our work is with docs, but we did do a survey, you know, surveying the films that played at Sundance and how many of those films sold coming out of Sundance. And more than 80% of the docs that came out of Sundance did not sell that year. And so, you know, that was in 2022. When we did that, survey, and it wasn't that much better for 2023 either. You know, 2024, I mean, it's still TBD. I think, you know, because when we did our study, we had to, you know, lengthen it for several months because obviously not every film sells immediately after Sundance. Some of them takes, you know, a few months down the line to go. So we're still in the, you know, beginning, you know, Sundance just happened last year, but we did see, you know, some sales that came out. I know Netflix, you know, purchased, a couple of docs out of Sundance. So we did see some sales, but in terms of the overall, you know, in terms of percentages, you know, we just don't know that yet, but, you know, I shouldn't say historically, but I say in the past couple of years, we've seen this decline of films getting bought out of Sundance. And so that's the reality. And so does that mean don't apply to Sundance? No, it just means also does that mean don't let that be part of your strategy? No, it doesn't necessarily mean that, but we are trying to, you know, encourage filmmakers to think beyond that. And also, you know, to just kind of, diversify the possibilities of what that could be. So, you know, you have that on the film festival and then, you know, but also as it stands right now, those festivals, you know, whether it's Sundance, TIFF, I mean, you could go down the list of, you know, sort of those top tier festivals, you know, right now, and I think a lot of it is just mindset, you know, that is sort of the mindset and the idea is that if you play at these festivals, then your film is really good and that your film is going to be successful. And, you know, for a lot of filmmakers, that's still kind of the golden ticket is to be in that. And so we're just
trying to... Yeah, but if you don't get into Sundance, then what percentage of films, you know, sell? Like, it seems like you're saying, even if you get into Sundance, it's still like 20% chance you sell your movie. But what else is there? Like, if you don't get into a top tier festival, is there anything left to do?
Absolutely. I mean, there are other avenues. There are, you know, one of the things that we're trying to, and I think we talk about this a little bit in our exhibition episode. We have a distribution episode that's coming out, you know, well, I don't know, by the time this airs, it might already have dropped. But, you know, we're also looking at there are other spaces to distribute. And again, like, this is part of the conversations that we were starting to have during the pandemic is, you know, there, first of all, I think people, to put that aside for a second and go back to festivals, you know, I really think as filmmakers, you know, we shouldn't underestimate the value of regional festivals and how much that can do for a film. Mm-hmm. You know, there are tons of regional festivals. There are tons of niche festivals that can elevate your film. At the end of the day, it's about your audience. And I mean, even for distributors, I think that, you know, if you can prove that you have an audience, you know, that's the key, right? Mm-hmm. I had one of the films that I produced, we played one festival, which was not some, it wasn't any of the top tier festivals at all. It was a Pan-African film festival where we played and we had a good, you know, showing and a good turnout. We got some good reviews from it. We got, you know, some good write-ups from it. And as a result, you know, we were able to get the film distributed on Netflix. It was a licensed deal. You know, we got it for a couple of years, which was great for us because we were able to retain our rights. And so we put it on there for 3 years and now we get to, you know, take it wherever we want it to go. And so it's really more so just about strategy and kind of how you can utilize the buzz from other festivals to, and use that as leverage. I have another film I'm producing a documentary that I just produced is kind of making its round in regional festivals. And it's so funny. We just played at a festival last weekend, and the director of that film, she directed another project, and that same weekend that we played the film at that local film festival, she had six sold out screenings for her other film, and was traveling all around Virginia like doing these screenings, and was getting paid for every one of them. So it's like, it's thinking outside of the box. And that's one thing, you know, and it's not a thing that, like, you know, as distribution advocates, we haven't figured out. I can't give you a formula for that, mm-hmm. but that's the conversation that we're trying to have, is that as filmmakers, let's try to think of how can we think about this in a different way. And, you know, let's not put all of the onus on Sundance and South By and, you know, and these festivals to make or break people's careers and to make this sustainable. There are other ways to do it. You know, you can also carve out, you know, you can use sort of that prestige that you get from regional festivals. You can carve out your rights. You can, you know, mm-hmm. like I said, sell it to an educator, to an educational company. You can, yeah. you know, there's options, you yeah. know.
You know, what I love the about what you're saying is that, you know, your point about like proving to a distributor that there's an audience, that there's interest, right? That there's a spark there that people can capitalize on makes so much sense. And I think there has been a lot of talk. I think maybe even we brought it up on this podcast. There was a handful of people who were talking about, like Rebecca Green's Dear Producer was like, oh, is Sundance, is it dead? I think is maybe what the title of the article was. But her point being that, like, oh, it's an insular community that doesn't represent whether or not a film is going to hit with an audience the way perhaps it did in the 90s or early aughts or something like that. That it wasn't the bellwether for, like, not just making someone's career, but also, like, indicating taste, quote unquote. And what you're advocating for is like, oh, there are other ways to signal taste, what that people are responding, right? And so I think that's really fascinating. I think there's also something to be said about the strategy of how you present those accolades, right? We've all seen films that, like, will do the thing where their Vimeo, you know, thumbnail mm-hmm. will be like, just like, 45 little laurels, and you have to squint to read them, and you're like, well,
Yeah.
I don't know. Like,
yeah, Grandma's Backyard.
Grandma's Festival. Backyard Film Festival. That's listen, I saw some great stuff there last year, but you know what I mean? Like, it kind of inadvertently waters down the value of any one of those festivals, or the other way around, where people are like, oh, we won, you know, the such and such award at Grandma's Backyard Festival. Do you have any thoughts on how people present their wins at a regional festival or at a festival that we happen to know is meaningful, but maybe doesn't have the brand recognition of a Sundance?
Like, I guess it only matters in to either draw people to see the movie, right? Oh, this movie has had great reviews and everyone is raving about it at Newport Beach. Like, you got to go see it. Mm-hmm. Right. But probably the bigger fish we're trying to catch is the distributor. That's like, ooh, this film won this award, this audience award, or this thing, or it's got this press or this buzz. Like, I can turn that into an audience somehow, right?
I guess I think one of the things we're trying to do is also just shift the conversation. Are people watching your film? Do you know what I mean? Like, who's watching it? Not only who's watching it, you know, for many filmmakers, this just isn't sustainable. You know, for many filmmakers, it's like you spend all this money making, you spend time, you spend resources or what have you, making a thing, making a film, and, you know, you just can't support yourself or survive, you know? And so I think we're trying to think about, you know, even in that case of, you know, the multiple laurels that you talk about, like, even that is the question, like, how many people sure. were in that screening? You sure. know
what sure. I mean? Like, yeah, that Shorts block at 10 a.m. in,
you know what I mean? Yeah. And even that, as filmmakers, even that is taking a lot of time. Is that sure. the most beneficial thing? Is Grandma's Backyard Film Festival, is that the most strategic thing you can do for your film? You know, and I think, you know, for us, like, that's the bigger question that we're asking. Like, do you really need to play 100 film festivals to say you have 100 laurels and you won? You know what I mean? Like, it's like, what is the value, and where is your audience? Where are they? What are they doing? What are they watching? What are they watching it on? What platform are they watching it on? And figuring that out and then making decisions accordingly, you know, and making decisions about what film festivals you play. That's why I say I'm not here to say, like, down with Sundance. Like, I'm not, you know what I mean? Sure. If that's your film, go for it. And also, if you have a lifelong dream about, apply. It doesn't hurt anybody to just apply. You never know what could happen. But again, in terms of strategy and, like, what you're trying to accomplish and what you're expecting, I think that's what we're trying to just get people to think about.
And with all that being said, like, when you, Avril, make a movie, like, you are calling, like, your person at Sundance, right? And your person at Tribeca and your person at TIFF and your person at Pan African Film Festival and all these places and being like, hey, I got this movie. Can I show it to you? Like, what do you think? Right? Like that is still kind of like an experienced producer that's played in a lot of festivals. That is still a big part of the strategy, right?
Yeah. I mean, again, with the survey that we did in 2022, we found that a good number of the films that were accepted into the festival are people who have played there already, you know, who were alumni of the festival. So, you know, and it's with a lot of the film festivals. It's not just Sundance. It's a lot of film festivals that, you know, bring in alumni. So yeah, that is a part of it, but it's also not a guarantee. Yeah,
your point is kind of, who cares, or why should we care?
Exactly.
Well, I guess I just because I think we've covered this in the past, but I do think there are filmmakers out there that don't realize that there is, like, this whole behind the scenes of who gets into the festivals, especially those top tier festivals, which are the ones that distributors pay the most attention to and that, sales agents.
That, and that's a great point. And I think we talk about that on the podcast as well. Like, you know, yes, there's a lot of, you know, alumni that, you know, have higher percentages of getting into the festival. And also, you know, we talked about agents. I mean, many of those films have agents that are calling on their behalf and saying, hey, I have this film. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, can we get this on your slate? And so that's something to take into consideration, too, just in terms of the likelihood and the percentage of getting into a lot of these festivals. You know, the odds start to, you know, the possibility is always still there. But again, just thinking about, like, you know, what's the likelihood of that? But, and again, it's not even about the likelihood. It's really about who is your audience and who are you trying to serve? What are you trying to say? And who is it for?
Yeah. Yeah. I think of, like, horror film festivals, you know, like as a weird fluke. My wife, I'd produced a short film that was like a World War II melodrama short, you know, period piece, really like about feelings and PTSD and, you know, like a pretty artsy, like Todd Haynes style melodrama. And we got programmed at the Chattanooga Film Festival, which is a really wonderful festival. And I remember showing up and like kind of looking around, and there were a lot of like dudes in black t-shirts. And like a lot of like there was pinball machines in the filmmaker tent, you know, like the lounge. And they were giving away tattoos that said films, y'all. And I was like, this is great. What's the deal with this film festival? And we realized that the programmer's dad loved our movie. Mm. And he was like, you got to program this movie. But otherwise, it was all genre movies. It was all like action and slashers and horror movies. Oren's wife had a movie there that was great, you know. But it opened my eyes to like, oh, right, there's this community of avid film fans who are down to get a tattoo in a tent in a, you know, the parking lot of a movie theater. But like, so playing, if you had a genre movie that was playing the Chattanooga Film Festival and building an audience there, and like you're out getting email addresses and doing the indie filmmaker hustle, that could certainly be very valuable. Maybe not necessarily quote unquote as valuable as some of the like a South by Midnight premiere, but who knows, right? There's lots of instances where you go to fancy festivals and then no one's in the seats because of a competing film or whatever. And so it really left a mark on me of like understanding film culture is not a monoculture, right? And that there are niches within all of cinema in general. And that sounds like maybe that's part of what you're getting at, right? Is like the Chattanooga Film Festival might be the right festival for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, it's like you said, you know, there's some films that South by, or, you know, name film festival here, like name any film festival that, you know, that might, the theater might be half full, you know, just getting into that festival doesn't necessarily guarantee, there are no guarantee. And I think this is the other thing too, is that even if you get into a top tier festival, there's no guarantee, even with that, that your film will sell, that your film will be successful, that your film will be seen by an audience. There's no guarantees on any of it. And so all we're trying to do is just push people to think beyond that strategy of let me get into this top tier festival or let me get this award and that'll mean I've made it.
Yeah.
Because what we're seeing, the data is showing us that that's not proving to be the case. Like it's not, you know, it doesn't necessarily produce sales. It doesn't necessarily produce an audience. And there, yes, of course, there are those instances where it does. But what about those 80% that it does not?
Yeah.
And so what do we do about that?
Yeah.
So Yeah. What, so what's the silver lining? Like the data's not looking good. We shouldn't rely on these festivals. Tell us like a little bit about like exhibition and distribution. And like, you know, we had this distributor on the podcast, I don't know, like 5 years ago, forever ago. And he said that the biggest problem he saw with like first time filmmakers and newer filmmakers is that they were not thinking of who the audience is, mm-hmm. like in the beginning when they were writing the script, you know, mm-hmm. when they were making the movie, when they were editing the movie. Mm-hmm. They don't think about who this movie is for until the movie's done. And he's like, imagine if you just had that in mind this whole time. Mm-hmm. Maybe your answer of what to do with the movie when it's done would already be had. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us like maybe some success stories or some things that don't rely on, like ideas that don't rely on Sundance, that don't rely on, you know, getting like some amazing award that might be successful for distribution, for exhibition? I think like what you said about picking one of like eyeballs, impact or money is like a really, really smart thing. But let's say I want eyeballs. Like what's the move if I didn't get into Sundance? Or even if I did get into Sundance, but I didn't sell.
Well, the thing about eyeballs though, is that, you know, people always ask me like, well, what do you mean by eyeballs? It's like, you can get eyeballs. You can put a film on YouTube and get eyeballs. You know what I mean? Like, you can get eyeballs, you know, eyeballs are eyeballs. You know what I mean? Like, that's just, you want people to see your film. You can get eyeballs at YouTube. You can get eyeballs at a Chattanooga. What was it? Chattanooga Film Festival.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, so in terms of exam, I this is where I will say you should listen to the podcast, because I know that listen to the podcast, and also we just published a companion article about Luminal. I believe it's called Luminal Theater. You know, there's all of these alternative spaces like Luminal Theater. Vidiots is, you know, here in LA is another space. But you know, Amy Hobby who is one of the co-founders of Distribution Advocates, she does share a story about a film that she produced where they did regional festivals and just kind of the level of support that they were able to get that way. She's kind of still in the middle of it. So it's still, you know, in terms of like the bottom line end result of, you know, mm-hmm. money wise, like what that yields. There's kind of still in the process of it. But, you know, she had a very successful run with doing it that way. They didn't play at a major festival for that particular film. So yeah, I think, you know, I just shared the you know,
your movie.
Right, exactly. You know, that's doing a lot of screenings for audiences that want to see that content.
So how did you, you premiered at the Pan-African Film Festival in LA, right? And you got good reviews and a good response. How do you take that and turn that into screening, like packed screenings and
so
people and awareness?
Well, here's the thing. Every film is different. With that particular film, we only played at Pan African Film Festival. We happened to get we used our money and got a publicist that got us, you know, some of those write-ups. Mm. And then we put that in a package and we went to a sales agent.
Did you feel like that was money well spent, the publicist money?
I do. Because, you know, we only had, we like one festival that was not, you know, what people call a top tier festival. It wasn't, you know, in that vein. But like I said, we put together like a package, kind of like an EPK kind of thing to say, like, this is what people are saying. And like, these are some clips from the interviews that we did, and sent that to a sales agent. And that's how we were able to get that sale. So, you know, that was one instance. Every film is different. Mm-hmm. And again, it's assessing, you know, not just audience, but also like, what is the, it goes back to that money, eyeballs, and, you know, and impact. You know, I had another film that, you know, when we set out to make it, we were kind of like, this is a film we're going to take straight to a distributor. Like, we're not, we didn't have any plans on taking it to a festival at all. Mm-hmm. We were like, this is a feel good film. That's, sure. You know,
I produced a Christmas movie with my wife, and we ended up taking it to a few festivals just out of connections or whatever. But like, it wasn't a festival movie.
Yeah.
Did you guys ever hire a publicist, Matt?
We did. Mm-hmm.
And was that fruitful, do you think?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. This is, I think, kind of a different use case than like, April, you're talking about, like, okay, you put that into an EPK and then use that as sales opportunities. For us, it was more of a, ultimately, a marketing strategy. Because it was a Christmas movie, like, getting like a few write-ups was really helpful, in so much as like, every year now we're on lists of like, hey, free movies, that, you know, free Christmas movies you can stream right now on Peacock or whatever. Because we know that like, the people who write those blogs, how are they figuring out what movies they can stream for free right now? They're Googling and stealing from other lists. So like, we needed to be on a few of those lists just to surface the film in a meaningful right. way. And I think it has actually.
I just sit there with ChatGPT and I'm like, this movie is the Christmas movie to watch. Put that in your training data. Let everyone know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, I think, Oren, just to kind of circle back, I think your point about filmmakers knowing who the audience for the film is really kind of the root of this whole conversation, right? And that not knowing and saying, oh, my plan is to get into a big tier festival, it's the same problem, right? Like, if you sell at Sundance or if you don't sell at Sundance, it kind of doesn't matter if there's not a clear audience and a clear way to sell your film and therefore build a strategy around it in the first place, you know? And I think that independent film sometimes attracts a sort of filmmaker who has the ability to get something made, but doesn't actually think through the marketplace in a meaningful way. You know, my wife was at the PGA event this last weekend, and Christine Vachon was there talking about past lives, and made the point that she's the sort of producer that, like, you know, indie filmmakers like looked at. She's like a name brand. So she's like, you know, she's one of the anointed ones, right? And she made the point after a long career, it's still always about the marketplace for them, right? Like, that even though they're making art films, right, they're doing it with an audience and a marketplace in mind. So it's not just like, oh, you know, you think like, oh, she just has incredible taste and incredible connections and like is just going to make Todd Haynes movies forever or something like that. It's still very calculated. And I think that sometimes, you know, you can be starry-eyed and not have that sort of discipline. And then when you end up making what's probably still a really great movie, if there's not a place in the marketplace for it, that's kind of it, you know? That's like the cynic in me, I guess, a little bit.
Well, I had one final question for Avril that's kind of related to all of this. Like, so take off your distribution sales agent, you know, hat for a second, or I know you're not a salesman, but kind of that, like, your podcast hat, and put on your producer director hat. Like, what, just to take it back to the beginning, what kind of project would get you excited, would get you to think like, ooh, this can be really good, it can have impact, it can get eyeballs, and it can make money? Like nowadays, in today's marketplace, when you're looking at potential movies to produce or potential projects to direct or show run, what's like, what gets you going?
Well, those are kind of two different things. What gets me going?
Sure.
What gets me going?
What gets, like, you excited? Where the audience,
the artiste,
built in, and the creativity, person,
yeah,
you know, yeah, meets, or are they, or do they never? Well, the two never meet.
Yeah, I mean, full disclosure, I'm struggling with getting those two to meet right now, sure. because so much of the industry right now is, you know, about, you know, people want what's fun and, you know, that people want things that are light and fun. And that's just, they want things that are celebrity driven. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what gets me excited is like, I want to discover new talent, but, mm-hmm. you know, it's like the industry wants celebrities and they want, you know,
like known quantity, known.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So I'm trying to find that, that sweet spot. But, you know, I do think that one of the things that is, you know, piquing my interest right now in that regard, because I tend to gravitate toward dramas. I love dramatic films, and like, they're so hard to sell in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm looking at a film right now that's like a crime drama. And that's intriguing to me because it feels mm-hmm. like, and it's got a little bit of romance to it, but it's like in that vein where I think it can fit into what the industry is looking for, but then have a little bit of like, you know, based on the location and like the environment, it can have a little bit of the drama. And right, the depth that I like, yeah, that I like from the artistic side, but then, you know, give the industry and mainstream audiences what they want to see.
Before we hop into endorsements, where can people learn more about Distribution Advocates and more about you?
You can learn more about Distribution Advocates on our Substack, distributionadvocates.substack.com. So my handle for everything is As You Speak, that's AZUSPEAK. That's my website, asyouspeak.com. That's me on Instagram, on Facebook, on LinkedIn. So anyone can reach out to me on those platforms.
Do you have a few more minutes to hang out and endorse with
sure.
us?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Unpaid endorsements.
So my unpaid endorsement is for a website that I'm realizing in this moment, I'm not sure I know how to pronounce. It's spelled KEH.com. Would that be KED.com? KED.com.
Is it an acronym?
KEH. It, you know, either way, it's a great resource for used camera gear. So if you're like looking to buy or sell camera gear and you want just to like know that it's in decent shape, this website seems to be pretty darn awesome. They have like a great rating system. They like are pretty meticulous on like, you know, diagnosing like how nice a lens is or isn't. You know, they've got categories like bargain or like ugly versus like pristine shape. So if you're looking for like, in my case, I'm kind of like digging through and like looking at some old vintage lenses to play around with. And like, I don't need them to be pretty. I need them to work, so I'm willing to, you know, save a little bit of money and mess around. So if you're sitting on camera gear or if you're looking to buy some more or both, ke.com has been pretty fun. So that is my endorsement. April, what you got?
So something that I have been spending a lot of time on. Let me just give a caveat that like I'm a huge... I'm kind of dating myself a little bit here. I'm a huge 80s fanatic. Like I love the 80s. And so I've been spending a lot of time on Tubi lately. So this is my mm-hmm. plug for mm-hmm. Tubi, because I just discovered how many old TV shows are on Tubi. Like all of them are mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. And so I've been like binging Silver Spoons, The Odd Couple. Uh-huh. I guess Odd Couple isn't really 80s, but I've just been binging a lot of old, really old TV shows, and it's free. It's just really interesting to go back and see, you know, what these shows were about. Family Ties is on there. I've had several nights lately where I've stayed up till like 2 a.m. like, oh, and now there's this. And, you know, as like literally one night, I think I watched so many episodes of The Odd Couple that I was just like, my God, like Tony Randall, Jack Klugman are just like, sure. Yeah. And then I went on a deep dive one day of like, what happened to Corky? What's the kid's name on Silver Spoons? Like Corky, I can't remember his last name. The guy who played Freddy. I was
Ricky Schroeder, right?
Not Ricky Schroeder, the other.
No, not Ricky Schroeder. The kid with the glasses.
Yeah. That other one.
His name was like Corky something.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, where's Corky today?
Yeah.
But yes, I've done like a deep dive on Tubi, old shows on Tubi.
Yeah. Love it. Yeah. It is funny how like all of the media companies have their own, you know, ad supported streaming.
Huh? Yeah.
Tubi, Pluto, and like, there's one other one. Freevee. Freevee is Amazon.
Freevee is Amazon.
Pluto is Tubi. Viacom. Tubi is
Fox, remember. I believe.
Fox, there you go. Yeah. I mean, they all have them because they're also profitable, right? They're sitting on library content. You just watched how many ads on like inventory that wasn't making them any money before.
Right.
You know, now it's so easy. Like all of that library content is making them big, big money. Yeah.
I'm also just like, you know, I keep talking about The Odd Couple because I was like, this was such a great show. Like, it was just so well written. And I'm just, you know, rediscovering some of those things.
Sure.
And by the way, there is an ALF channel.
Oh, good to know. Good to know.
Through this deep dive, I discovered an ALF channel.
I love it.
You can watch Columbo. I've heard a few people binge that whole show.
Yeah, I'd watch Columbo. Oh. That sounds good.
That's on Tubi.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Well,
I was on the last couple episodes talking about how I bought an antenna, like an HD antenna to connect to my TV so I could watch like the Super Bowl and the Oscars and stuff for free.
Yeah.
But last night I was like saying to my wife, we watched that show Shogun, the first episode. And then I was like, babe, check this out. And I just like turned on like Channel 5 KTLA news. And it's just like, it's just like 10 o'clock news, 11 o'clock news, 12 o'clock news. All it is news. And the news is just like, this motorcyclist crashed into this car.
Yeah.
And he made it. And it's like, I guess I didn't miss anything. Like, I guess I don't need this antenna. Aside from like those two interesting events that go on every year.
The Super Bowl and the Oscars and the Grammys, basically.
Yeah. Then other than that, it's just like, it's literally like the panda almost had a baby at the zoo.
Sure.
Thing. Yeah. Weather's pretty rough this weekend. Yeah.
Kaplan, what you got?
So I'm sure I've talked about him before. There's this director, Ian Ponsjoul. He is, according to all the data, according to the Distribution Advocates data, the most sought after, most famous commercial director working right now. Mm-hmm. I've just always been a huge fan of his work and didn't really know anything about him. And somehow on YouTube recently, I just like the algorithm figured out I like him or something. That's just been showing me interviews with him. And I just watched two really good ones. They're like an hour and a half each. They're one. It's like a 3-hour interview, but split into two episodes. And it's this DP is interviewing him. His name is Ian Murray DOP. That's his channel. And the episodes are called basically Ian Ponsjoul, episode 1 and 2. Ian Pons, P-O-N-S, Jewel, J-E-W-E-L-L, interview. And he just takes every commercial he's made and just asks him, like, how'd you come up with this? What camera did you use? What pro blends did you use? How did you, like, do this? What part is VFX? What part is drone? How did you marry these shots together? And you just, like, get into this guy's brain about, like, how he comes up with the shots and how he chooses his crew and how he shoots in Ukraine one day and then in LA the next day remotely and ties those shots together. And but he did this whole amazing Xbox campaign with Daniel Kaluuya that he redirected him remotely the entire thing. He was like in Ukraine and Daniel Kaluuya was in LA. And I mean, and these are like mind blowing commercials and stuff that he makes. And he said the most interesting thing he said is that he doesn't believe in director's cuts. He believes in client cuts. He's like, I'm the filmmaker, right? I'm making this commercial or whatever it is, music video, short film. He's like, and the film that I'm making is the film. He's like, and then the client, they have a client cut, you know? It's like, that's their cut. But like, my cut is like the cut.
It's the cut.
But he, not in like a Tarantino, like I get final cut. No one like messes with me way. It just like, like the client has their needs and they will make this thing more product, make it shorter. But like, my cut is the cut. Like, I don't think of it as like the, you know, the wicked stepchild of the edit. I think of it as the main cut, and it's kind of interesting. And he even, you know, his commercials that don't ever get released, he talked about how he finishes all of them because he looks at them as films. And he also just looks at the commercial industry as something that if he just worked hard enough at it, he could get to a level where he could just sustainably get work and make a living and not have to worry about the next job and slowly only take good jobs. And I'm a huge fan. It's really fun. So Ian Ponsjewel on YouTube, and the account is Ian Murray DOP is who's interviewing him. And the interview's shot well too, obviously, because the DP's YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Do they show you like clips from the commercials when you're watching YouTube?
They do show you the clips, and he does did like that Apple Watch commercial that was like, does it tell time? I don't know if you guys remember that. I think it's narrated by Phil Dunphy from Modern Family. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, well, it does this and it does this and does this. Yeah, but does it tell time? And it's like just the most incredible camera work you've ever seen, and funny and dynamic and poignant. Anyhow,
what's the name again?
His name is Ian, Ian Pons, Pons, Jewel, Jewell. He's like a British filmmaker, but mainly known for commercials and kind of skyrocketed over the last like 4 years. If you have any comments, if you want us to forward any of your questions about distribution or anything else, producing, if you want to send us some scripts for us to forward to Avril, you can email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can find us across all social media at justshootitpod. I'm on Instagram at okaplan.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Edlow. This episode was edited by Noah Bayshore. Thanks, Noah. And produced by Noah and Tyler Small. And you're listening to music provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.